From the studios of Radio Sai at Prashant Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And before I get into the topic of today's discussion, let us take a few moments to remember Mother Ishwaramma. Tomorrow is May 6th, the day of the Divine Mother left her physical body and merged in her most beloved Divine Son. The Sai organization around the world celebrates this day as the Ishwaramma Day. In many of his discourses, Swami has very beautifully narrated the last moments of Mother Ishwaramma. Swami says, and I quote, "It was the day before her passing away, and I suddenly asked her, in the midst of a casual conversation, 'Tell me, is there anything else you desire?' She said, 'I have finished my pilgrimages to all the temples. I have seen the biggest temple of all and the God that resides there. I have no desire for anything more.' But I knew that a small wish still lurked in the corner of her mind. She wished to give a gift to a granddaughter on her birthday. So I insisted that she should accept rupees 500, go to the bazaar and buy whatever she wished. I sent her along with a companion and she returned happy with what she had bought. On the 6th of May, 1983, Swami continued the narrative speaking in greater detail of Ishwaramma's day of deliverance. Swami says, and I quote, "The summer classes were on at Bangalore. In the morning at 7, breakfast had to be served to the students. They went round with Nagar Sangirtan and returned at 6. I gave them darshan at its close. Then I went for my bath. Meanwhile, Ishwaramma had finished her bath. She drank her coffee, as usual, quite happily, and took her seat on the inner veranda. Now, all of a sudden, proceeding to the bathroom, she cried out, 'Swami, Swami, Swami.' At this, I responded, 'Coming, coming.' Within that period, she breathed her last. What greater sign of goodness is needed? She had no need to be served and nursed. Swami will come to the memory at that time only for a very few. The mind will usually seek and stay on some object or the other. From the ground floor she called, 'Swami, Swami.' I replied, 'Coming, coming,' and she was gone. It was like Gajendra's calling and the Lord proceeding to bless it." This is the authentic consummation that life must strive for. Beside her at the time, she had her daughter Venkamma and her granddaughter Shailaja, but she called only for Swami. Getting this yearning at the final moment is the fruit of holy purity. It is the sign of an ideal, adorable life. Such attitude must emerge on its own accord and not by means of some external force. So here is an example to learn from." Unquote. So dear listeners, let us all express our gratitude to the Divine Mother for showing us the many ideals that she stood for. And here is a beautiful song by Srimati Kavita Subramanyam.
Bhakti, Bhakt, Bhagavant Guru, चतुष नाम बपुए तिन के पद वंदन किए मिटत विघ्न
दिया तूने साई को
Welcome back, dear listeners. So the topic I have chosen for today is Satyam Vada, which means speak the truth. Now, most of us have heard of the Upanishadic dictum, Satyam Vada Dharmam Chara. It means speak the truth and act righteously. You know, truth has been given so much importance in Sanatana Dharma. In fact, truth is the basis of Sanatana Dharma. There are also dictums like Satyam Eva Jayate, that is, truth alone shall triumph. Or Satyam Nasti Paro Dharmaha, there is no dharma greater than truth. Swami says that God should be worshipped as the embodiment of truth. This is the primary duty of every Bharatiya. Now, when our beloved Swami was in his high school in Uruvakonda, he wrote a play. And in fact, he also acted as the lead character of this play, and the lead character's name is Krishna. This play opens, the first scene opens with a lady reading out the Bhagavata, the epic that narrates the story of Lord Vishnu and his devotees, to a number of other women. And she is explaining the meaning of the slokas. And in that she says that it is the duty of the housewife to give charity to the deserving, the unfortunate ones who cannot earn by the sweat, and not to the pretenders who lead idle and parasitic lives. So anyway, after this whole parayanam of the Bhagavatam is over, everybody disperses. And there is this little boy, Krishna, who is the son of this lady, sitting there. He was there all along listening to his mother talk on the epic of Bhagavatam. Then a blind beggar comes and asks for alms. Now this lady rebukes this beggar and sends him away, telling, "No, I don't have anything, go away." After some time comes along a very hefty mendicant with a big belly and a polished copper vessel in which he has some grains in it, and he has a very richly decorated tanpura. And the mother very respectfully welcomes this person. She offers him rice, money, and then she falls at his feet asking for his blessings. And this little boy, the son, Krishna, watching all this, he is confused. He asks the mother why she has not followed what she had preached a few minutes ago when she said that charity should be given to the deserving, the unfortunate ones, and not to the pretenders. And the mother gets very irritated that the son dared question her, and she told him, "Cheppinattu chestara." In Telugu, it means, "Can we act as we say?" And the mother, out of her irritation, she takes the son to his father, who was an upper division clerk in an office. So she takes the son to the father and says, "Look at your son. Nowadays he is questioning my actions. You better tell him something. Tell him something, advise him the correct way." So the father starts to talk to the son, and he gives the son a long lecture on the importance of education, how children should not, waste time, and how people should study and get educated, whatever the difficulties that may come. And as this lecture was going on, a schoolboy comes into the office. And this schoolboy comes and asks this father, who's the officer in that office, for some money to pay his fees. He says that, "Sir, today is the last day, the due date is getting over today, and if I don't pay the money today, my name will be struck off the rolls and I will lose an ear. My father is a very poor person and he doesn't have the money to pay the fees, so will you please help me?" Now this father, he says that, "No, I'm sorry, I have no money." He even pulls out his wallet and shows him as, "See, I have no money in my wallet, so I also can't help you," and sends the boy away. A few minutes later, a batch of young men, all clerks belonging to this office, they come in with a slip asking for a donation because a new person is joining this office, and these clerks, they want to throw this new person a welcome dinner. And the father is very happy. He says, yeah, "This is very important. It must be done very grandly so that the new person who is joining is very happy." And then He says, you know, even I can make a speech on that day. Please give me some time for that. And then he pulls out a very generous donation from his drawer in his table. Very big substantial amount, and he gives it to these clerks and tells, come on, take this and have a nice dinner ready. Again, this boy, Krishna, who was watching all this, is completely aghast. And he asks his father, why did you go against your word? Why did you utter that lie to that schoolboy? You could have rather given that money to the schoolboy who was really deserving than lavishly spending on some meaningless dinner party. And this father gets very angry and he says again, Cheppinattu Chestara. That means, can we always act as we say? And then he scolds the child and says, why are you here in this office? You should be at your school. Go to school. Now, the whole scene shifts to the school. This boy, Krishna, and now he enters the school. And the teacher who is taking that day's class seemed to be very excited, because the inspector of the schools is to visit the school the next day. And the teacher is very excited because he is going to coach the students so that he can impress the inspector tomorrow. So he tells the students, he asks the students, so boys, how many lessons have been completed? And all the students answer, sir, 23 lessons. He says, no, when the inspector comes tomorrow, tell him that 32 lessons have been completed. And now I am going to teach you the 33rd lesson. So all the boys nod their head. And he goes on to teach the 33rd chapter in the book. And this chapter is on Harishchandra, the legendary king who sacrifices everything to uphold truth. So he teaches them that lesson. His idea behind teaching the 33rd lesson today is that when the inspector comes tomorrow, he's going to teach this lesson tomorrow as though he's going to teach it the first time, so that the students now already know the answers. So if we ask a question, the students will give the correct answer and the inspector will be very impressed. Now the class is done and all the students, they disperse. But this little boy Krishna is sitting in the class very dejected. So the teacher asks, you know, why he is still here, why he has not gone. And this boy questions the teacher, why do you not follow the advice you give? And the teacher again tells him the same answer that he already heard twice during the day, that is, Cheppinattu Chestara. Do you mean to say that the advisor should follow the advice? So finally, the final scene happens in this boy Krishna's house. So it is the next day morning. It is a school time, and Krishna, the boy, refuses to go to school. He throws away his books by saying that going to school is a waste of time. Now the parents are panicking. They don't know what happened. Suddenly what has happened to this boy? So they call the teacher home. They send word for the teacher asking, look at, my son is telling like this. What is wrong? So the teacher comes rushing in. Because, you know, even the inspector is supposed to visit. You don't want any student missing in the class. So he comes running and he says, what is going on here? And then this boy says, if all that you teach us as mother, father and guru is only to be spoken and written, if all that is learned is to be discarded when it comes to action, I do not understand why I should learn anything at all. Now, so this opens the eyes of everybody, all the three, and they praise the boy as their guru and decide thereafter to speak the truth and live by the truth.
Thank you.
Dear listeners, so all the great spiritual masters only gave advice as per their own actions. You know, most of you would have heard the story of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Once a mother of a small boy came to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and complained that her son was eating a lot of sugar every day. She tried everything possible to make him stop eating sugar, including even beating him or giving him something else in exchange. But all her efforts were futile, and she was ready to give up on him. So Ramakrishna very intently listens to this lady and tells her, "Mother, can you please come back after 2 weeks?" Feeling a bit disappointed, the mother thought, okay, maybe the great saint had something in his mind, and she consoled herself and she left. She came back exactly after 2 weeks and asked Ramakrishna Paramahamsa to do something about the problem her child has. Now Ramakrishna calls the boy, makes him sit on his lap and told him that eating sugar is not good for health and too much sweet is not good. He asked the boy to stop eating the sugar, and then he told the mother that the boy will hopefully stop eating because I have told him now, so she can live happily. Now the mother was very angry. She said, I traveled so far with my child, not once but twice, anticipating that you will do something about the issue, but all you did was to ask him not to eat. I mean, you could have done the same thing when I came the last time, so I didn't have to spend so much money coming here again. Ramakrishna smiled and said, you know, I'm really sorry to make you travel twice, but I had my own reasons, you see. I used to eat jaggery or sugar every day when you visited last. The reason I asked you to come after 2 weeks was because I wanted to stop eating sugar before I could ask your son not to eat. And dear listeners, it is the same with our beloved Swami. You know, one day in the interview room, Swami was sitting with few devotees, and there was this man who had this bad habit of using snuff. Now, snuff is like a powdered form of tobacco which people would inhale through their nose. And because of this habit, this man's handkerchief was stained black. So in the interview room, when he removed the handkerchief, Bhagwan noticed the stained handkerchief, and Bhagwan scolded him on his bad habit. And that's when Swami noticed his own handkerchief, which was stained red in color, because in those days Swami used to chew pan, which is the Indian thing which is made up of betel leaves. Now, if you notice old photos of Swami, you will notice his lips are bright red in color because of the pan extract. And that day, dear listeners, Swami gave up eating pan just like that, because he felt, how can he comment on another person on the stains of his handkerchief when his own handkerchief was stained? So dear listeners, our Swami never asked us to do anything he didn't do himself. That is why he says his life is his message. Everything he has said was something he has lived himself. You know, when Swami advocates simple living, high thinking, it is because that's how he lived. When he said, love all, serve all, that is because he loved all and served all without any discrimination. Swami once asked a student what he planned to do after his MBA. And this student replied, Swami, I want to serve you. And to his surprise, Swami said, why do you want to serve me? I don't need servants. I am everybody's servant. You are all masters. So this student was very hurt hearing that, and he protested by saying, Swami was the only master and all of us are his servants. Now Swami was not ready to give up on his statement, nor was this student, who felt it was a blasphemy to even think of Swami as a servant. So finally, as expected, Swami had the final word. He said, I always keep doing whatever you want. My only concern is to give you joy. But do you always do what I want? Now tell me, who is whose servant? And this boy was left speechless and stuck by the profundity of Swami's statement. Also, during the earlier days, during the birthday celebrations, especially, Swami used to conduct Narayan Seva in the Hillview Stadium, where thousands of poor people would be fed. You know, in recent times, we saw Swami's students doing Narayan Seva and Gram Seva, but in the earlier days, Swami used to do it himself. As a student, I had the great opportunity to serve prasadam to the devotees assembled in Sai Kulwant Hall many times. And because the devotees are seated on the floor, you have to bend your back while serving. Let me tell you, after you serve for 5 minutes or so, you will experience the worst kind of pain in your back. Your back muscles would cramp up like anything. And here was Swami continuously bending his back and serving his devotees in the stadium, not even in Sai Kulwant Hall under the sun. He would be dripping with sweat, and throughout, he would exhibit the same enthusiasm while serving each and every Narayana who had assembled. Not only would he serve food, he would also tell them to eat well and tell them not to forget to collect the share of clothes that were being distributed. So dear listeners, Swami was not somebody who sat on the throne and gave orders. He set an example by his own actions. Now, even if someone has not heard the phrase Satyam Vada Dharmam Chara, even if you have never attended a spiritual education program or a Balvikas program, everyone at least must have heard at school the phrase, honesty is the best policy. That is, so speak the truth. In other words, on a lighter vein, you know, there are people who are very honest in their comments. They say, you know, I'm a very honest man. I call a spade and I don't mince my words. And these kind of people, they pass comments on others telling they don't mind calling others overweight or look at you, you look so old. In fact, there, about 2 weeks ago, I met an acquaintance of mine, I mean, not even a friend of mine. And the first thing he looked at me and said was, you seem to have put on some weight. You know, so the kind of comments that can hurt other people. Is this the kind of honesty that we want? Is this the kind of honesty that the Vedas are asking you to say? You know, the Vedas declare that there is also a knack to speaking the truth. It is not enough if you speak the truth. You have to speak the truth the right way. And what does they say? Satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat, na bruyat satyam apriyam, priyanchanan ritam bruyat, esha dharma sanatanaha. That is, speak truth in such a way that it should be pleasing to others. Do not speak the truth that is unpleasant to others. Never speak untruth, which might be pleasant. This is the path of eternal morality, Sanatana Dharma. So, to speak truth is an eternal value, irrespective of time and place. But the expression of truth should be accompanied by two conditions. Firstly, it should be presented in a loving manner, and secondly, it should be spoken for the betterment of others, not to put other people down. How you speak is as important as what is being said. One should be very careful of speaking truth by not hurting others. You know, Swami tells this beautiful story of how Lord Krishna, by his knack, solved a big problem for the Pandavas and also for sage Durvasa. And here's the story. You know, during the Mahabharata war, one day Ashwatthama, he took a vow that he would behead the Pandavas before sunsets. Now, those days, you know, if a person takes a vow, that is a very serious affair, because people took their words very seriously. So Draupadi came to know about this and she prayed to Krishna. She said, I don't want anything. I don't want the kingdom. Please save the Pandavas. Krishna said, see, that is not in my hands. The vow that he took cannot be changed. Draupadi pleaded with Krishna that nothing in this world is beyond your capacity. Everything is in your hands. If you will, you can do anything. Saying thus, she fell at Lord Krishna's feet. Now Lord Krishna blessed her and immediately chalked out a plan. In the darkness of night, he went to sage Durvasa. The Pandavas who accompanied the Lord waited outside as instructed by Krishna. To protect his devotees, the Lord has to enact many roles. If he does not act, the play simply loses its significance and becomes uninteresting. And Krishna told Durvasa, see, I have come here with a purpose. It is a very difficult task. You have to help me. Durvasa said, see, I'm ready to do anything except telling a lie. Okay, Krishna said, uttering lie is not acceptable to me also. I am divine myself. I always adhere to truth. How can I tell you to utter a lie? I have made a plan. Please act according to it and everyone will be happy. So Durvasa asked, okay, Lord, so what do you desire? So Krishna says, okay, so now Ashwatthama is trying to hunt down the Pandavas. And I want you to give them shelter. I want you to let them hide in your ashram. And Durvasa said, okay, that is fine. They can take shelter in my ashram. They can hide here. But when Ashwathama, if he comes and asks me where the Pandavas are, I cannot tell a lie. So Krishna says, it's fine, no problem. You dig a big pit and then put a strong plank over it and place your throne on that plank and then you sit on it. The Pandavas, let them hide in the pit under you. So when Ashwathama comes and asks, where are the Pandavas, did you see them? You tell them in a harsh tone that Pandavas are under my feet. You know, Durvasa was known for his temper. So Ashwathama searched everywhere and at last came to Durvasa and then he asks, you know, O venerable sage, do you know where the Pandavas are? And then Durvasa tells with a lot of anger that, yes, they are under my feet. And then Ashwathama gets scared because he didn't think that Pandavas are literally hiding under Durvasa's feet. He thought, okay, the sage is angry, let me leave. Let me not get cursed by the sage. So, thinking so, he ran away from that place. So, there it is, dear listeners. Use your intelligence, discriminate, and then speak the truth.
Love is my fall, truth is my bread, bliss is my food. My life is my message, expansion is my love. My life is my message, expansion is my love. Love is my fall, truth is my bread, bliss is my food.
From a small group of people who visit Swami, today the numbers have swelled to thousands and thousands. Why?
No reason for love, no season for love, no birth, no death. No reason for love, no season for love, no birth, no death.
And the people who flock come from all over the world. Why?
Satya Dharma Ananda, Prema Shanti Ananda, Shri Sai Satya Sai Prema Shanti Shri Sai.
Swami is sweet in his speech, ever smiling, extremely polite, and forever willing.
My life is my message, expansion is my love. My life is my message, expansion is my love. Love is my fall, truth is my bread, bliss is my food.
Respect to parents, elders and leaders, love and concern for others, and very patient.
My life is my message, expansion is my love. My life is my message, expansion is my love.
Swami loves his students, the flora and the fauna, the plant and the animal kingdom, loves his devotees, loves all, and serves all.
My life is my message, expansion is my love. My life is my message, expansion is my love. Love is my home, truth is my prayer, peace is my food. Love is my home, truth is my prayer, peace is my food.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Earlier I said that all the spiritual masters speak only on the basis of their actions, and they speak the truth. Now, what is the truth? When the Vedas declare Satyam Vada, or speak the truth, beyond the superfluous meaning, what is the truth that we have to speak? You know, let's take a moment and listen to a beautiful story. This is a real life incident that happened in the 80s to a student of Swami's university. So let's listen to Brother Sundar Iyer narrate his experience. This audio excerpt is taken from a video interview series done by Ted Henry of Soul Jones.
So here's how it started. Many years ago in Puttaparthi, I was walking one day after my yoga session back to the hostel, and I found some village urchins jumping up and down and hitting something on the road. And when I got closer, as I walked past, I saw they were hitting a snake. And my heart immediately went out to that snake. And they were jumping up and down, hitting in Kotra, Kotra, and all, you know, they were talking in Telugu, and nobody had, as I watched it, nobody had the guts to hit the snake on, it was a cobra, nobody had the guts to hit it on its head, which I later learned would be the fastest and the easiest way to kill a snake, not by hitting the rest of its body. So this poor snake slithered away, more bruised and more dangerous, I guess, than before. And these boys were saying, good, good, you know, we should not allow this. That's why I tell you, we have an amazing way to justify whatever we do. We can kill a snake and justify it. We kill human beings and justify it in the name of religion. We, you know, it's fascinating how we can justify anything and everything. You know, so I was so upset with that. I said, never again will I allow a snake to be killed in my presence, as long as I know. I have a fascination for snake. And I didn't realize it till that day that I had the secret love for snakes. I know it doesn't sound, my wife will go yuck, but I do. And so I started catching, and Puttaparthi, the name of Puttaparthi is anthill, the house of snakes, the name itself. So there are plenty of snakes, and being the tropical climate, there's plenty of cobras, the brown cobras. And so I ended up catching these little snakes. From little, it became medium-sized snakes, then it became big snakes. They would sneak their way into the college campus, or somebody would spot them in the hostel, right behind, you know, where the garbage was, the food was dumped. And so where the food is dumped as waste, before they picked up, there are rats. And where there are rats, there'll be snakes. So it wasn't uncommon for us to bump into cobras here and there. And slowly, the word spread around that, hey, Sundar can catch a snake. Initially, I had told them, if you see a snake, let me know, because I don't want you to start killing it. I can catch it and then take it away and put it out somewhere. Now, I figured on my own how to catch a snake. There wasn't a Discovery Channel then. I would have perhaps avoided this accident of mine. But I just figured, you know, you take a stick and press the head down and put your thumb on top of the head and slowly and carefully put your fingers under its mouth, and once its mouth is there, he just coils around you, but he, poor thing, is doesn't have any strength to do anything. He's more struggling for his life. And then I would take him back to the hills and then leave them out there. Now, as I said to you in the earlier interview, where the good deed starts with a good intention, then it becomes all about the deed, and all about the intention is slowly forgotten. And so I slowly started enjoying the limelight that I was in when I was catching snakes. I mean, you become a popular teacher now, so you have all the students coming to you and saying, hey sir, come on sir, show us, next time you catch a snake, let us know. And I said, yeah, I will let you know. So one thing led to the other, and foolishly, I would actually catch a snake and then make the boys touch it and say, feel it. Now, this is done in the zoo, after heavy training, so that you don't have accidents. Now, this is me just desiring to be adventurous and sharing that adventure with boys and say, hey, don't be scared, touch the snake, it's okay. And see this mouth, and this is how the poison is coming out of its teeth, and not realizing that that's a cobra I'm holding. I mean, I realized it, but I probably didn't understand the impact of what I was doing, potentially not putting myself in danger, but everybody around me. There were times where I would take the snake and put it around my neck and leave him. And I would say, look, the snake is not out there to kill you. He's going to find his own way first, because he is now on a survival mode. So I would leave him and then let go of my hands and the snake would obviously slither down. He's not going to turn around and say, who is the one who, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became that I was a popular snake guy. And everybody got to know me as the one who catches cobras. And then, you know, so the villagers, the locals in Puttaparthi, because of the hostel and college, and everybody got to know about it. So anywhere in the mandir now, there was the Prashanti mandir, in the college, in the hostel. So my territory, my fame expanded. It became quite popular that I could catch snakes. Finally, I think there was this afternoon, I was sleeping, and this is the only time I can share with you something which is personal, but I think it has to fit in the whole story as it goes. And I'm just being very honest and upfront over here. I was sleeping, and in the midst of a vivid dream, and I'll come to that vivid dream later, which is actually a prologue to the story, but I'll come to it later. I was in the midst of a vivid dream, and I was woken up around 2:30 or so in the afternoon. I was taking a small siesta because I didn't have classes to teach, and I was taking a siesta in the hostel. Somebody woke me up and said, Sundar, there's a snake in the college. And I woke up and I said, you know what, by the time I go there, there's going to be no snake. I mean, no snakes waiting, you know, in a corner waiting, hey, Sundar is going to come and catch me. By the time people spot a snake and they call me and I go, invariably the snake wouldn't be there. So I asked this boy, are you sure he's there? Because by the time we go, I knew there was time. It was time for darshan. It was around 3 o'clock. And I said, by the time I go and the snake is not going to be there, it's just a waste of time. So I'm not coming. He said, no, the snake is there. It's by the small cages, by the bioscience laboratories. And he's been cornered. He's in the concrete floor. He's not moving. And there are people around, made a big circle. And there are some villagers with daggers and sticks waiting to kill it. So we have told them, wait, Sundar will come and you don't have to kill it. So I said, all right, I'll come. And since I got up from sleep, I wore my Hawaiian sandals, you know, like the one you're wearing, where your toes are all completely exposed, like this famous Puttaparthi sandals.
Flip-flops,
thank you. Flip-flops. I wore the flip-flops, quickly wore my flip-flops and started walking towards the college. Normally, I would wear shoes. I would always remember to wear sneakers. By then we were in sports meet and we had sneakers and things like that. But that afternoon, I don't know, I wasn't thinking correctly. I wore my flip-flops and started walking to the college. And I go there and I see the snake in the corner and all these people around them. Say, hey, Sundar's come. There's literally a cheering crowd waiting for me. People with cameras. I have the picture of me holding that snake.
Mm-hmm.
I have it here and I have a soft copy of it in case you want to put it out there. But I feel very ashamed though. Anyway, they took pictures of the snake of me. I mean, anyway, I went there. I look for a stick. I put the head down, caught him. And this guy was huge. He was almost my height, 5 foot 5 inches. Huge snake, and I had to hold him like this instead of, you know, usually the mouth I would hold like this, but this was, the mouth is so big, I had to actually hold him just like this. It was this thick throughout. Anyway, so I catch him and then tell the villagers and everybody to go away and then pose for some pictures. And that day was the first time when somebody took pictures. And so I posed for pictures, put the snakes, stretched the snake out and called one boy of equal height, and that boy stood and I said, oh my gosh, don't be scared, I'm just measuring the snake's height. I was in cloud nine, literally, enjoying the glamour and then all the good intentions are still there, but I think that was way out forgotten. And I walk up to the Hanuman statue was not built then. The Krishna statue was built. So the Hanuman statue was just the top of the hill. So I decided to go all the way up there and throw the snake out on the other side. Now as I walk up to the Krishna statue and go up to the Hanuman statue, and I was about to throw the snake, a bunch of students came running behind me. Normally I wouldn't allow them to come all the way up to the hills, because now you're in snake territory. You're not in the compound, in the concrete. They came up and said, oh sir, we missed this whole thing. Come on, every time we miss it, every time you catch a snake, we miss it. And please show us again how to catch a snake. We never know when we'll get a chance again. And I decided that day, all right, you know what the heck, let me show them how to catch a snake. So I looked around for the same stick which I pressed the head, and I didn't find any. And I said, oh, you know what, I'll just try a new thing. I'll just put my foot on top of the head and press him down. This is all going in my head, and literally was I thinking that I'm wearing flip-flops, and like that could be a dangerous yeah. thing that I'm trying
you
with a wild snake.
Might be a morsel for that snake to sink its fangs into.
Right. And so I hold the tail of the snake, and I show, and I, of course I tell them I had basic sense to keep them at a good distance, tell them stay there and watch. So I held the tail of the snake and let go of the head. And so the snake cannot climb on its own body, but so the snake was going like this on the ground, and I held him far out like this, and his head was on the ground. I let it down a little bit, so his head was on the ground. He was trying to escape. Poor thing. He's fighting for his life. He was not out here to help me with this freak show that I was putting up. And so when I saw his head and his hood spread out like this on the ground, I thought it's a good time now to put my foot on top. I put my foot on top of his head, looked up at the boys and said, this is how you first hold his head. That 10 seconds or 5 seconds or whatever it took for me to do that, I didn't realize that this is not a concrete floor underneath. Because when I put a stick on top of the snake could not go underneath because it was concrete floor. I never caught a snake in the wild. So when I put my foot on top, I thought he stays pressed, but he is fighting for his life, and that's pure muscle. So he dug himself underneath the sandy ground, which is very easy for him. He dug himself underneath, and now my foot was right in his sight. He gave one nasty bite.
Mm.
A 5-foot, 5-inch cobra, mm. a huge snake, gave me one nasty bite and let go.
What was your immediate reaction?
Now you would think, and that's why I said I'll be upfront and humble and honest here. You would think a person who practiced 10 years of yoga, completely into Swami's fold, meditating, at this point, I would have thought, I would have said, Swami, Sai Ram. I said, ouch. All that came from my mouth was, ouch. No Sai Ram, no Swami, nothing. That was the last thing probably in my mind. So that's again another thing is how you think you're ready, but you're not. Anyway, it didn't really matter, I guess. At that point, I felt a sharp twinge of bite. I knew it bit me. So I quickly flung him into the bushes, and I maintained a straight face, and I told the boys, oh, hey, it's okay, let's go back. Two of my colleagues were with me. They saw this happening. They were much closer than the other boys. The other boys didn't know exactly what happened. So these colleagues, two of them, they said, Sundar, have you been bit? I said, yeah, I think I've been bit, but let's go to the hospital. Don't worry, it's okay. My initial thing was negation. I just wanted to negate the whole thing as if it didn't happen. Because it was too much for me to think of what if it's true. So the immediate reaction was, oh, no, nothing. It's not big. I'll just go to the hospital and take a blade and slice it out and let the blood flow out, and I should be okay. And then as I started walking from where the Hanuman statue is now to the Krishna statue, which is probably a couple of hundred yards, by the time I started walking down, then the pain hit me. All of a sudden, it started hitting, and then I thought my foot was on fire. Because that's poison. I couldn't even take a step. The pain was unbearable. That's when I realized I cannot go to the hostel. I have to go to the hospital. Which is again walking distance. I wasn't afraid of snakes because I've caught them so many times. The thought of death and other things didn't hit me yet. All that, the pain was so immense, I told the boys, okay, let's head to the hospital. Two of my colleagues were with me. So they said, all right. So one of them was a science student. He said, Sundar, you're not supposed to walk. It's a snake. Cobra has bit you. Let us carry you. I said, carry me? No way. Look at, create a scene. I don't want to be carried. The great snake Chama cannot be carried. I said, I'll walk to the hospital. I did everything that was not the right one. Mm-hmm. I tied a tourniquet, but I tied it in the wrong place. And I tied it in the ankle out here, if you can.
Yes.
And the reason why I want to show it is because I did take the precaution as I thought. So I tied a tourniquet here, but apparently both sides are bones here. So when you tie a tourniquet here, it's not going to be helpful. You should tie a tourniquet here. But I tied it here.
Okay.
And this is the place where the snake bit me. It's a big mark. It still hurts me. And the
big mark. It's huge.
This is exactly where it bit me. And it became a mark. And I'll come to this in a bit. But so the tourniquet that I tied here was not helpful. Apparently, as the doctors told me later, he said, that is not wrong. That's the wrong place you tied a tourniquet. Hey, like I said, there was no Google, there was no place, there was no way for us to prepare for this. Anyway, so I walk to the hospital and Dr. Alreja is waiting there to greet us. Now, as I'm walking to the hospital, though the pain was unbearable, I'm still talking to my colleagues and I'm telling them, hey, listen, We go there, Dr. Alreja is going to be there. Now, I have been in Baba's room and I know every evening Dr. Alreja meets Baba. So now it's hitting me like, oh my gosh, what have I done? What have I done? I mean, I could be sent home for this stupid act of trying to be a snake charmer and putting myself in danger. What if Baba gets to know about this physically? I mean, you know, pardon us, because we are so close to him, sometimes we treat it. What if Dr. Alreja gets to know what happened? And if he tells Baba this, I'm going to be out. Baba is going to get so angry at what I did. He would send me out of the ashram. And so I tell these boys, please let me do the talking. You guys don't talk. I'm going to stretch the truth as much as I can. And I'm going to tell Dr. Alreja that I was in the college, I was doing social service, and I got bit by a snake. Social service was one of the things where boys would go dig up roads and help villages do, you know, out there working, cut grass for them and things like that. So I'll tell them I was in the college doing social service. And my definition of social service was helping the place get rid of snakes. And
sure.
So
well, it would loosely stretched thin enough, maybe cover possibly a little bit.
Justify. Justify, right? I justify that I'm still speaking the truth. But if I left it there, then if he goes to Swami, he can tell whatever he wants. I didn't want him to get into details of what exactly happened. So we walked there, and exactly as I expected, Dr. Alreja was there. He said, what happened? We said, snake bit us. He said, oh my God, lie down on the bed and stretcher. And then as he was wheeling me up, he said, what happened? How did it bite you? You know, because he knows me personally. He said, what, Sundar, how did it bite you? I said, oh, in college I was doing social service and it bit me there. And we left it at that. He said, okay, okay. He took my pulse and he didn't like what he saw. And so he went up and put me in a room and immediately ordered for the antidote. So I'm lying there. I looked at the clock. It was close to 4 o'clock or so. And then I'm waiting for the antidote to come. After 5 minutes, I noticed a little bit of unrest among the doctor. And somebody came and told Alreja something. He said, you look worried. He walked away. And one of my colleagues came back to me and he said, Sundar, it's okay. It's okay. No, nothing happened. I said, I didn't even ask. The moment you say nothing happened to me, I know something has happened. So what is it? He says, don't worry. The guy who was the antidote, because the hospital was small. There was one steel almirah where all the medicines were kept and antidote was in that. Now the person who had the key to it had locked it and gone for Baba's darshan, which was at 4 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So now to open that almirah, it was a glass, you could have broken it, but the almirah was steel. So to get it, you've got to send somebody now to the ashram, get him or get the key and come back. And they said, oh, somebody's gone to fetch him. Don't worry, in 5 minutes he'll come back. And that's when I told this boy, I said, listen, if he's gone for darshan and if Baba's out for darshan, nobody's going to disturb him. Going, coming, and I knew the darshan was out there. It would have been on now. And so I said, it would take him at least 40 to 45 minutes for us to get that antidote. So it's not going to work. And that's when it hit me that I could die. And I said, okay, the antidote is not coming. So, and it's a cobra that has bit me. And already about 12 to 15 minutes has already passed by. And I was kind of feeling faint, but other than that, the burning sensation was keeping me alive, actually, in a way. So I couldn't really drift into that. I didn't know. So I told him, okay, I'm going to lie down and I'm going to practice something. And you wake me up before they inject me. And he promised he would. I lay down. Mrs. Prem Behel, she is from the primary school, the warden of the primary school then, the principal of the primary school. These are two wonderful ladies. And I'm sure you would meet them when you go to the ashram even now. And she was there. She was a very elderly woman. She was gently, you know, her hand was on top of my head, just gently like a mother. My parents were in the ashram. They have no idea this is all going on. Anyway, she was there and all I remember was I lay down and I closed my eyes and I was preparing myself for the death. And being into yoga and crazy as I was, I think I still am, my wife thinks so at least, I was wondering how should I exit my body. And I had read about Walter Coven's story and other story about going through the dark tunnel and seeing the light at the other end. I said, am I going to do all that? Am I going to go through a dark tunnel? I was more excited about the concept. I have to die consciously. I have to allow and become one with the light. And I want to exit through the Sahasrara Chakra. And that is my training for yoga. So I was lying down and preparing myself because I knew there was no possible way I could survive. So I lay down and started focusing on the light, filling my body. But to be very honest, the pain was so real that I had a difficult time doing this. It's okay when you're lying after a nice yoga session and your mood is perfect, but it's a different thing when your foot is on fire literally with poison there and you're trying to meditate and calm yourself down.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I remember, it was 5 minutes before somebody woke me up. All because I was conscious throughout. There were no dark tunnels and lights. I wish there was. I would have written $1 million, a New York bestseller book, but I couldn't, unfortunately. There wasn't any of those. There wasn't any supernatural experience at all, other than the fact that I was completely conscious of the pain, and I was waiting for this death to come. And somebody shook my shoulder. I opened my eyes, and he said, "The antidote has arrived." I said, "What, in 5 minutes? You got the antidote?" He said, "What do you mean 5 minutes? Look at the clock." I saw the clock. It was 5 minutes to 5 o'clock. It was almost 45 to 50 minutes later. And now I cannot explain, even today, what was that. For me, I was conscious. It wasn't like I slipped into some zone and I came back. I was conscious. I knew it was 5 minutes. But actually, it had already 45, 50 minutes had passed by. Anyway, I came. They gave me the antidote. They said they're going to keep me overnight for an observation. And I survived. And I came. I survived there. I ended up staying, of course, for a couple of weeks more because of my foot injury. It became localized and things like that. Story is not over yet. So in the evening, my father comes along with my mother, and of course, he let go and he said how foolish I was. And I said, "Promise them I won't catch a snake again." And Dr. Aldeja walks in and he says, "Oh, Sundar Iyer, you have been telling us all lies." I said, "What do you mean lies?" He said, "Baba told very clearly that it is not a snake, it is a thorn."
A thorn?
So, it's a thorn. And I said, "What do you mean?" Baba said. And then he explained to my dad and me what happened. He said, "No, when I couldn't find the antidote, and you were lying, and I knew your pulse was falling, I immediately called the ashram. Mr. Chiranjeevi Rao was there on the phone, and I told him, please inform Swami, ASAP, that Sundar Iyer has been bit by a snake. I don't have the antidote with me to give him right now." So his job was, when there's an emergency like this, let Swami know. Because he didn't want Swami to ask later, "Why didn't you tell me?" It was your job to bring it to my attention, right? So he wanted to bring it to Swami's attention that I've sent for the antidote, but it's not available, and there's a snake bite. So he knew that there's no way somebody could survive a snake bite. The picture here, my father then recalls what happened. Though he didn't recall the exact dialogue, my father recalls Swami passing, coming out for darshan, and as he was crossing the ladies into the gents' side, those days there was an arch in the sand. Okay, the arch, under the arch would be the ashram officials would stand. And they would not normally come in the way of Swami and his devotees, unless there was something so important that couldn't wait for later in the evening. So Mr. Chiranjeevi Rao stepped out. Swami asked what it is. And then Mr. Chiranjeevi Rao told me this story later on. As he told Swami, he goes, kneels down Swami and says, "Swami, Sundar Iyer ki paamb karsindanta." That means Sundar Iyer has been bit by a snake. And Swami immediately retorted back. He says, "No, that fellow is a drama boy. He's just doing it for my attention. It's not a snake, it's a thorn." It almost like rebuking him, saying, why did you disturb me for such a trivial thing?
That's amazing.
He's doing a drama, it's not a snake, it's a thorn, don't disturb me for this kind of a, something like that, and walked away back into the darshan. So Chiranjeevi Rao called back, and he probably was strong, in a strong voice, he told Aldeja, "What do you mean, you're making me disturb Swami for these trivial things?" So Aldeja comes later and tells me, "Sundar, you have been telling lies, this is what happened."
But what would account for the pain and the venom and whatever came off that thorn? Must have been like a snake venom.
You and I know it's a snake. And all my friends knew it was a snake. I knew it was a snake. But here's the thing. Here's the whole thing. I was so upset that evening when I heard this verse. I said, "No vibhuti, no nothing. All I get is this kind of a thing. And Swami just puts me down. Make me look like a fool." It was a snake, Swami. Come on, give me a break. You can't say it's a thorn. I was thinking in my head. All right. 2 years later.
2 years later.
I never got an answer for it. I kind of, went past that story and I forgot about it. I always wondered, why was it that a snake bite, a cobra bite, which is supposed to be systemic in nature, which would cut your oxygen supply to the brain and immediately kill you within 15-20 minutes. How was the whole thing localized in my foot? And then it became a local wound, and the wound was treated, blah blah blah. That's a whole different story. But I was always wondering why and how. I mean, I didn't have any supernatural experience either, so it was like a big thumbs down for me. But I definitely learned the lesson that I would never go and do this snake catching incident, at least not in public's view. And I kind of completely refrained from doing any of such things again. 2 years later. Now, that's why I said there's a prologue and an epilogue for this. Let me finish the prologue now. As I was lying that night in the hospital, and I was thinking of the day's events, that's when it hit me how foolish I was and how serious I could have been in trouble. And I actually died. My parents left and everybody left, and I was just going to sleep. And then it struck me that the afternoon, I, if you remember, I told you I was in the midst of a vivid dream and I was woken up. I went back to that dream and it hit me all of a sudden. In that dream, I had died, and I'm opening a manhole, and I'm coming out of it, and there's very cloudy skies, and I see my grandfather and great grand aunt and all these people around me. It's fascinating. I'm seeing all of them in this dream. I recollected that dream, and as I'm saying this now, I can get that dream. It was so vivid and clear. And I look around, and in a distance, a palanquin is coming towards me. 4 people are carrying a palanquin. They put it on the ground, and the curtain parts, and there's Swami inside. He says, come here. So I go to Swami, and I kneel down, and Swami says, do you want to come with me, or you want to go back down? And I look at Swami, and I'm thinking of the chances I'm getting with Swami down there. I'm thinking, Swami, I want to go down. He said, good, take namaskar. So I remember touching his feet, and I was woken up, and all this happened. I didn't even have time to recollect that dream until that night, which was, for me, very fascinating as to what was it. But then I just dismissed it as a dream. I said, yeah, okay, maybe it was a coincidence. Maybe there's something I don't know. Maybe it was something. I just didn't put two and two together. The epilogue came 2 years later. So I had forgotten about it. 2 years passed, and the gymnastics, more gymnastics took place, sports events and dramas went on, and more occasions to meet Swami, and other things took priorities, and this was a long forgotten story. 2 years later, Swami's 65th birthday, or I think it was around that time, I was sitting and we were discussing the drama and the play, and then Swami was talking to me, and I was making all the notes, and towards the end we all got up, touched Swami's feet and got away. And I got up too to touch his feet and leave the room, when he looked at my feet down and he said, what is that mark on your foot? Because by then it's a scar which is there even today. And he says, what is that mark on your foot? I froze. I said, no, sorry, please don't make me say anything. I'm going to get into trouble now. I don't want to, you know, you're standing in his presence. I couldn't obviously lie or even stretch the truth. I have to be blunt and honest about it. But I hated to face the consequences of something which I had done 2 years ago. I looked at him, he said, what is it? Why is that such a big mark? Very innocently. And I said, Swami, snake bit me. Swami, Pamba Karasandhi. That is a snake bite? Is it a snake? It wasn't a snake, was it? He looks. And I'm looking at Baba, and I'm telling him almost instantly, no, Swami, it was a snake. Now, I want to pause for a second here, just because in Krishna and Arjuna's relationship, Baba would often tell this story, and it's a very common story from the scriptures. He would say, Krishna would look at a parrot and tell Arjuna, look at that crow. Mm-hmm. And Arjuna would say, oh, but that's a beautiful crow. And he would say, oh, it's not a crow, it's a parrot. Arjuna would say, oh, yes, it is a parrot. And then, so Krishna said, don't you have something of your own? If I tell it's a parrot, you're saying yes. If I say it's a pigeon, you're saying yes. Arjuna told him, if it's a parrot for you, it better be a parrot, because I would say yes, because you can change a crow into a parrot into a crow. I would say yes. Now, I thought, I like that story, but here I am, when he asked me, looking into my eyes, it wasn't a snake, it was a thorn. Wasn't it? And I'm looking at it and saying, no, Swami, it's a snake.
Well, that part you hadn't said until right now. So he actually said that to you, that
it was a thorn.
No, it'll come to that. Okay. What he said, it wasn't a snake, was it? I said, Swami, no, it was a snake. I wasn't an Arjuna then. Again, another humbling factor for me. I think of that today and I said, maybe I should have just agreed with Swami. But my senses and everything for me We cling to our own reality. That's what I think.
The truth as you saw it.
As I saw it, but that's not, what we see here is not the truth. That's the whole beauty of it. Anyway, so I said, no, Swami, it's a snake. He said, Chichi, your imagination, go, he said. As I was leaving the room, he paused, he said, listen. And that time it was a different voice, completely different voice. A voice of one who knows, listen, he said. I turned around and looked at Swami. He said, from my mouth, I will never say, it is a snake. It is a thorn, it is a thorn, it is a thorn. From my mouth, I will never say it is a snake. Na note nunchi adi mullu ni eppudiki raadu. Na note nunchi adi paambu ni eppudiki raadu. Adi mullu, mullu, mullu. Po, he said. And as I came out and sat in the bhajan hall, I was shivering because the truth of the statement hit me. And then I recollected 2 years ago when Chiranjeev told him, at that moment, there was no time left. It was just at that time when he had to desire and will it. There was no time even to write in the air and wave palms, no time to create vibhuti and send it to me. Almost instantly, in a matter of rebuking, he said, no, it's not a snake, it's a thorn, he's an actor. So he made the whole thing as a drama, as a play. He made it into an act and he made the snake bite into a thorn. And he willed it as if it's a matter of, no. Now I realize why that was so fast and so abrupt and so sudden from his voice.
He
said the sternness in his voice was willing it then and there.
So welcome back, dear listeners. So once you know the truth, once you are established in the truth, whatever you speak becomes the truth. For Swami, whatever he uttered, it became the truth. And let's not forget that it is the same truth that is in us too. You know, about 2 decades ago, another student of Swami was browsing through few books in the institute library. And he came across an interesting book written by a Nobel laureate in physics. And since he himself was a physics student, he thought, let me browse through this book and see what it contains. And something caught his attention in the book. And it was a debate between an atheist and a theist. Now, this boy knew very well that you cannot prove or disprove the existence of God through arguments. And the only way to know God is through inner inquiry. But after reading that debate, he felt a bit disturbed. Because even though he knew that matters pertaining to the spirit are beyond the mind, because he was a science student, and his thinking was quite rational, the arguments of the atheist seemed logical to him. So because of that, he felt very uncomfortable and he felt guilty that he read this book. So he prayed to Swami. He said, Swami, I'm sorry I read this book. Now you have to give me some nice message. You know, I want to feel good. So please tell me something nice. So praying thus, he went to the spiritual section of the library. He pulled out a Sathya Sai Speaks book. And he opened a random page. And to his astonishment, the content read thus. Why do you worry about arguments between atheists and theists? And then Swami went on to say that these arguments are like two men standing on the ground and arguing whether the plane that is flying above has a pilot or not. The only way to be sure is either by going up or waiting for the plane to land. So dear listeners, how lucky are we, for the plane has already landed. We had the most amazing and rare opportunity to know the pilot in person, to talk to him, to experience him. But to be convinced about the pilot credentials, to prove the pilot credentials, we have to see him in the cockpit flying the plane. And for that, dear listeners, we have to go inside and see the cockpit of our hearts. And that's where we will truly know the truth. That we ourselves are the truth. That we ourselves are the truth or God we are trying to discover or deny. And with that, dear listeners, we are at the end of today's segment. And we have the live Telugu segment, Sri Sathya Sai Divya Sandesha Jhari at 3:30 p.m. Stay tuned. This is Chandu Vijay signing off with a prayer. May all the beings in all the worlds be happy, happy and happy. So till I see you next week, Jai Sai Ram.
to the